All right, so you ready to dive into another fascinating legal case? This one's a real game changer, especially if you're into the world of sports law.
Absolutely. Always up for a good legal deep dive.
Perfect. Well, today we're looking at Mackey v. NFL. This 1976 case out of the Eighth Circuit really shook things up for the NFL. I mean, we're talking about player movement, free agency, and the power dynamics between the league and the players' union. Definitely a landmark decision.
Yeah, Mackey is absolutely essential if you want to understand how antitrust law works in the unique world of pro sports. And for all you law students out there, this case is like a masterclass in how courts analyze restrictions on trade in a really specific industry, one with its own set of rules and challenges.
Right, exactly. So let's start with the basics. At the center of this whole case is this thing called the Roselle Rule. Can you break down for us what exactly was this rule and why did it end up in court?
Okay, so picture this. It's 1963. The NFL owners, they come up with this rule. It basically says if a player's contract ends and he wants to sign with a new team, well, that new team has to pay the old team something. We're talking draft picks, other players, sometimes even cash.
Oh, wow. So even after a player fulfills his contract, he's not really free to just go wherever he wants?
Exactly. And it gets even more interesting. If the teams couldn't agree on a fair price, guess who stepped in to decide?
Let me guess. The commissioner.
You got it. The commissioner at the time, Pete Rozelle, had the final say, hence the name Rozelle Rule.
So I can already see where the players might have an issue with this. It sounds like it put a huge roadblock in the way of true free agency.
Oh, absolutely. And the impact was pretty dramatic. Between 1963, when the rule was adopted, and 1974, only something like 34 players actually switched teams after their contracts expired. Think about that. Lots of players finishing contracts, but hardly any switching teams. The compensation demands were often so high that teams just wouldn't risk signing free agents.
Wow, yeah, that's a tiny number. And I can see how that would really impact players' salaries, right? If
Yeah.
no teams are really competing for you, you have way less bargaining power.
Exactly. So the players, they argued that the Rozelle Rule was a blatant violation of antitrust laws. They said it illegally restricted their ability to sell their labor in an open market, and it was keeping salaries artificially low. I mean, it kind of sounds like a classic antitrust case, right?
It does.
Yeah.
But of course, the NFL had its own side of the story, didn't they?
Oh, for sure. The NFL's main defense was that the Rozelle Rule was exempt from these antitrust laws. Their argument was that it was part of their collective bargaining agreement with the NFL Players Association. So it fell under this thing called the non-statutory labor exemption. This exemption basically says that if certain conditions are met, agreements made through collective bargaining between employers and unions are shielded from antitrust scrutiny.
I see. So this labor exemption adds a whole other layer of complexity to the case.
It definitely does. And it leads to two really crucial legal questions that the court had to grapple with.
Okay, so as I understand it, those two questions were, first, was the Rozelle Rule actually covered by this non-statutory labor exemption? And second, if it wasn't exempt, did it then actually violate the Sherman Act?
Exactly. And the court ultimately sided with the players on both of those questions. They said, nope, no labor exemption here. And yep, this Rozelle Rule is definitely a violation of the Sherman Act. It's interesting, though, there's a little wrinkle. The district court initially found a per se violation, but the Eighth Circuit went with the rule of reason instead.
Okay, I'm curious about that difference between per se and rule of reason. But before we get into that, let's unpack this whole labor exemption thing a little more. What exactly was the NFL's argument for claiming this exemption, and why didn't the court buy it?
Well, their main argument was pretty straightforward. They said, look, we talked about this Rozelle Rule with the NFLPA as part of our collective bargaining process. It's related to our labor relationship, so it shouldn't be subject to antitrust laws. They essentially argued that these laws are meant for businesses competing with each other, not for regulating the relationship between employers and employees.
Okay, so that sounds somewhat reasonable on the surface. So why didn't the Eighth Circuit go for it?
Well, the court created a really important three-part test to figure out when this non-statutory labor exemption actually applies, and it's still used today. First, they asked, does the restriction mainly affect only the people directly involved in the collective bargaining? So in this case, is it only affecting players who are currently under contract with teams?
That makes sense. It has to be directly related to that specific employer's employee relationship, right?
Right. Second, they asked, is this agreement about something that's a mandatory subject of collective bargaining? Those core issues that employers and unions have to ne negotiate over, like wages, hours, working conditions, things like that.
Okay, so far so good. What was the third part of the test?
The third part was crucial. They asked, was this agreement actually the result of genuine, good-faith, arm's-length bargaining between the two sides? Did the union and the owners really hammer this out in a fair and equal way?
Ah, okay, so it sounds like the Rozelle rule might have stumbled a bit on a couple of those points.
Yeah, you could say that. On that first part of the test, the court pointed out that the Rozelle rule didn't just affect current players who were still under contract. It also affected players whose contracts had already run out. That means it was impacting guys who weren't technically in an employer-employee relationship at that moment, so it kind of overreached.
Right, so that already weakens the NFL's argument for the exemption.
Exactly. But where the NFL really ran into trouble was with that third part of the test, that whole good faith bargaining thing. The court did some digging and found out that the owners actually just imposed the Rozelle rule unilaterally back in 1963. And that was way before the players' union, the NFLPA, had any real power at the negotiating table.
So it was basically a power play by the owners.
Pretty much. And sure, there were CBAs, collective bargaining agreements, in 68 and 70. But the court specifically pointed out that there was no real evidence of genuine arm's-length bargaining over the Rozelle rule itself before those agreements were signed. It wasn't a true give and take, you know?
So the NFL couldn't just hide behind the existence of a CBA. They had to show that the players had actually agreed to this specific rule.
Exactly. And because they couldn't show that real genuine negotiation had taken place, the court said, sorry, NFL, no labor exemption for you.
Interesting stuff. So, okay, the labor exemption argument is out. Now we get to that second big question, right? Did the Rozelle rule actually violate the Sherman Act? And you mentioned that the Eighth Circuit used this rule of reason approach, which was different from what the district court did. Can you explain why they chose that path?
Sure. So the per se rule is what the district court used. It's basically a shortcut. Courts use it for things that are just obviously anti-competitive, like price fixing or companies agreeing to divide up a market. It's like, we don't even need to look at the details. This is just bad for competition. But with the rule of reason, it's a deeper dive. The court has to weigh the potential harm to competition against any good reasons for the rule. You know, does it have any pro-competitive effects? And the Eighth Circuit recognized that pro sports leagues are a unique animal. They need some special rules to function and to keep things kind of balanced.
Right, because every team has to have a chance to win, otherwise no one would watch. So they couldn't just apply a black and white rule to a more nuanced situation.
Right. Exactly. So under the rule of reason, they had to really analyze the Rozelle rule's impact.
Makes sense. So what were some of the specific factors that the court considered when they were applying this rule of reason?
Well, first and foremost, they looked at the impact on player mobility. And like we've been talking about, it was huge. The court actually used the phrase perpetual restriction to describe how it limited a player's ability to play wherever he wanted. So basically, free agency was pretty much non-existent. Then there's the effect on player salaries. The court found that because teams weren't really competing for players, it kept those salaries down, which is a major antitrust no-no. And they also looked into whether the NFL had any other ways, you know, any less restrictive options, to achieve this competitive balance they were after. They even suggested things like sharing revenue among teams to even the playing field instead of this Rozelle rule.
It seems like the court was basically saying, hey, there are other ways to do this that don't hurt the players so much.
Yeah, exactly. And another key thing the court considered was how the rule was enforced. They weren't happy about the fact that the players had zero say in the whole compensation process. You know, if a player moved to a new team, he had no input on what his old team would get in return. The court called out these procedural flaws and said it wasn't right for the players to be completely left out of the decision making.
Yeah, it doesn't seem very fair to exclude the people who are most affected by the rule.
Mm.
Now, let's get back to the NFL's big argument that the Rozelle rule was crucial for competitive balance. How did the court address that?
Right. So the NFL was basically saying that without the Rozelle rule, richer teams would just buy up all the best players, and that would kill the excitement of the league. And the court acknowledged, yes, competitive balance is a legitimate interest. You know, it's important for keeping the league healthy. But they also said, hey, this Rozelle rule, it's way more restrictive than it needs to be. The penalty for signing a free agent is so high that it basically scares teams away from even trying. And they even made a really interesting point about the cost of developing players. They said, look, that's just part of doing business in the NFL. It's not a reason to impose these huge restrictions on the labor market.
So they weren't convinced that the Rozelle rule was the only way, or even the best way, to keep things competitive.
Not at all. The court basically said that the negative effects of the rule, like restricting player movement and keeping salaries down, were much worse than any potential benefits for competitive balance.
So the court basically ruled in favor of the players. What happened next? What was the immediate impact of this decision on the NFL?
Well, the most immediate impact was that the NFL had to completely rethink its free agency rules. This decision was a huge win for the players, and it led to much greater player mobility and more bargaining power for them. Teams were suddenly a lot more willing to compete for top talent, which naturally led to higher salaries. It was a big shift in the power dynamic between the league and the players.
Wow. So Mackey really changed the game. What about its lasting impact? Is this case still relevant in sports law today?
Oh, absolutely. Remember that three-part test the court created for figuring out the labor exemption?
Yeah.
That's still used today whenever a league or a players' union tries to claim that something is exempt from antitrust laws. Mackey really established the importance of genuine collective bargaining in sports. It's not enough to just say that something was discussed during negotiations. It has to be a real give-and-take process where both sides have a fair chance to make their case.
And you mentioned earlier that the court specifically encouraged the NFL and the players to work these issues out through collective bargaining rather than having the court step in and decide everything, right?
Yes, exactly. The court basically said, look, you guys know this industry better than we do. You're far better equipped to figure out what rules make sense for everyone involved. It was a pretty clear message that they wanted the league and the union to be the primary decision makers, not the courts.
Makes sense. So if you had to sum it up for our listeners, especially those in law school, what would you say is the core takeaway from Mackey v. NFL?
I'd say the biggest takeaway is this. Courts are going to look very carefully at any league rules that seem to restrict the freedom of players in the labor market. And unless those rules are very narrowly tailored to achieve a specific legitimate goal, and unless they're the result of real arm's-length negotiations between the league and the players' union, they're probably going to get struck down under antitrust law. Mackey really highlights this balance that the courts are trying to strike. They want to give leagues the flexibility to operate, but they also want to make sure that players' rights are protected.
That makes a lot of sense. Mackey v. NFL definitely seems like a watershed moment in the history of sports law. It really illuminates that tension that always exists between the business side of pro sports and the rights of the athletes, who are the heart and soul of the whole enterprise.
It definitely does. It sets a major precedent for how antitrust law works in pro sports, and it really underscores how vital the collective bargaining process is for creating a system that works for everyone.
Well, I think we've covered a lot of ground today. Mackey v. NFL is clearly a crucial case, one with long-lasting effects. It not only transformed the way free agency works in the NFL, but it also set down some fundamental legal principles that are still shaping the world of sports law today.
Absolutely. And it raises some really interesting questions for us to think about, especially as we see these ongoing debates about player compensation, free agency, and the power balance between leagues and players' unions. Remember what the court said about less restrictive alternatives? I wonder what those might look like today. We have so much more data and analytics now. We understand the game in a different way. How could those tools be used to create a system that's fair and competitive? It's a question worth exploring.
Lots to think about. And as always, thanks for joining us on this deep dive. Until next time.
See ya.